staff enter and exit crowded facilities with a particularly vulnerable population. Long-term care facilities around the country have been struck hard by COVID-19.
So that setting in itself is just sort of the perfect storm for transmission of an airborne virus like this.
I'm Cindy Rodriguez in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 5th, a look at long-term care facilities and how the vaccine is being rolled out to this at-risk population. We also hear from a facility in West Virginia.
Our residents, bless their hearts, we do family Zoom meetings, we do FaceTime, we do anything that we can to brighten their spirits.
And to round out the show, as part of our continuing coverage of Major League Baseball raising up the status of the Negro Leagues, we talk with someone who has seen it all firsthand.
The goal of vaccinating 100 million people in the first 100 days is a realistic goal. We can do 1 million people per day.
The rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine kicked off in the United States last month, and though it's off to a slow start, at least 4.3 million doses of either the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have been given so far, starting first with healthcare workers that have borne the brunt of the COVID-19 pandemic. Another top priority group is residents and staff of long-term care facilities like nursing homes, which have been hit especially hard by the pandemic. According to the COVID Tracking Project, more than 120,000 deaths have been linked to these facilities. That's nearly 40% of all COVID-19 deaths nationwide, despite less than 1% of the population living in these facilities. So far, the CDC has reported that about 365,000 people in long-term care facilities have gotten vaccine shots through a federal partnership with pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens. But the process of vaccinating this vulnerable population hasn't been without hurdles, whether that's nursing home staff refusing to get vaccinated or difficulty getting consent to vaccinate residents with dementia or Alzheimer's. And all this is happening as COVID-19 continues to sweep through long-term care facilities nationwide. For more on this, we're joined by Tamara Konecka, health economist and professor at the University of Chicago. Tamara, glad to have you with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Also here is Nathaniel Wexel, health reporter at The Hill. Nathaniel, welcome as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nathaniel, vaccine distribution is very different from state to state, but can you give us an overall picture of what the rollout has looked like for the nation's long-term care facilities?
Yeah, so most of the states right now are part of this federal long-term care partnership with CVS and Walgreens. And basically, as part of that program, every state orders a set amount of vaccines every week for their long-term care facilities. The vaccines go to the pharmacies, and these pharmacies show up at the long-term care facilities to hold essentially vaccination clinics.
I see. Is your sense that this is the way it's working for most facilities, or have some facilities chosen not to go that route?
Some facilities have chosen not to go that route, but really all but two states in the country are part of this program. So, we're not really going to know how well it's worked completely until we can compare sort of what's happened with the states that are part of this program and the states that haven't done it. So it's a little ways to go before we can sort of draw any major conclusions. But as you sort of pointed out at the top, like most of the rest of the country, vaccinations have been off to a pretty slow start in nursing homes.
And so, Tamara, can you tell us a little bit about why things have been slow? Are staff resistant? Are the residents resistant? What's happening?
I don't think it's so much resistance. I think just like the vaccine rollout more generally, there have been a couple of things that have made it a little bit slower than we would have hoped. It's hard to pin down the exact reasons, but, one reason is that there just wasn't enough overall planning for this rollout. And the second reason might be resources. Congress was late to approve the necessary funding for the vaccine rollout, and, we're asking a lot of the same people who are involved in the healthcare system already to now get involved in vaccine administration. And so the rollout has been slow in general. I do think that it's picking up, both in long-term care facilities and in the rest of the country. It is a huge undertaking, and I think we, you know, have to keep sight of the fact that this is, you know, even if it's slower than we would like, this is undoubtedly a really great thing for nursing homes and hopefully will dramatically decrease the number of deaths that we're seeing across the nation.
Nathaniel, have you had a chance to interview nursing home workers? And if so, what have you heard from them?
Not workers so much. They have been sort of reluctant to talk specifically. But I've talked to some clinics and some of the larger associations talking about sort of what they have heard from their members. And first it's hesitation, I guess would be the way to describe it. And it's not with every worker and it's not in every clinic. But you hear from some of these clinics, you hear from some of these governors talking about their clinics. For example, in Ohio, Governor DeWine said yesterday that more than 50% of the workers are just reluctant to get vaccinated. And from what I'm hearing, it's not necessarily that they're anti-vaccine. There's just some hesitation sort of about what's going on and the reasons why things are moving so quickly, general questions about why and whether it's safe.
Tamara, what do you know about who should get vaccinated first? Are most places vaccinating residents first, or are they vaccinating workers first?
It seems, anecdotally at least, because we don't have a lot of data on this yet, it seems that both are being done at the same time, which makes a lot of sense. We're not requiring nursing home staff to, you know, go elsewhere to try to track down the vaccine. And so generally, a vaccine day or clinic is set up, and the Walgreens or CVS representatives come in, and staff and residents are vaccinated at the same time, those who have agreed. Picking up on the issue of consent and willingness to take the vaccine, it seems, at least again anecdotally, that the vast majority of residents have agreed and are eager to get vaccinated, perhaps because they have so much at stake. The death rates among nursing home residents are just so much higher than among the younger population.
Now, what about the residents that have dementia or Alzheimer's and that are unable to give meaningful consent?
So what happens in that case, and that is certainly very common, in fact, the majority of nursing home residents have some kind of cognitive impairment. In that case, there's often a power of attorney or a family member who can give consent for that resident. And this caused some hiccups in the beginning in that, you know, the consent process wasn't entirely clear, whether it could be oral or whether forms had to be filled out, physical forms. Even if it's just oral, those kinds of things take time for facilities that are already stretched pretty thin just dealing with this pandemic. And so that caused some hiccups. My sense is that it's been getting smoothed out and that facilities have been able to get the appropriate consent so that we know that residents and their families actually want to get the vaccine.
And for either of you, do you have a sense of how long it takes for the vaccine to actually work? How long does it take for a person to build up the antibodies necessary?
So from my reporting, it takes about 2 weeks after the second dose to build up the full immunity. And each dose right now is given 3 weeks apart for the Pfizer one and 4 weeks apart for Moderna. So it's not an instantaneous thing. It's still going to take some time.
Right, right. So people are sort of celebrating right now, but the reality is that the relief is still a month or so away.
With either one of these vaccines, we also need the second dose, right? And so it's actually going to take a little while yet before, even those residents that get vaccinated have the fullest protection possible from the vaccines.
This program, it takes is three different visits. So people have different opportunities. They have multiple options to make sure that every resident and staff is able to get vaccinated. So, you know, there's the first visit, there's a follow-up, and then there's a third one just to make sure that they sweep and make sure that everybody is covered.
I see. Tamara, do you think that there's going to be huge lessons learned from this? You know, nursing homes are notoriously understaffed, and when you're understaffed, it is hard to contain the spread of infectious diseases. What do you think will come of all of this?
That's an interesting question. I've been hoping all along through the tragedy of this pandemic that the silver lining will be that we really rethink how we deliver and pay for long-term care in this country. Chronic understaffing is certainly pervasive in the industry. All kinds of quality problems have been challenges for decades, but we also just don't pay for the quality of care that we would like to have, that we'd all like to have as we age. Long-term care is one of those sectors that I think we just don't want to think about and don't really invest in. And the pandemic has revealed how problematic the entire structure of that is in this country. And so, you know, I'm hoping we'll have learned a couple of things. I'm hoping we have learned that we have to invest more in long-term care, that we have to think about the Medicaid rates that fund so much of long-term care, that we have to think about the fragmented way in which we pay for long-term care, and, you know, really as a society, try a little bit harder to create a system that we'd all like to have available to us as we age.
So Tamara, remind us why and how COVID-19 spreads so rapidly.
There are a couple of factors. One is that nursing homes house generally in very close quarters a lot of residents, mostly older adults, but also younger individuals with disabilities who have many underlying health conditions. That's why they're there. And those are exactly the risk factors that make them most vulnerable to adverse effects from the coronavirus. And so it's partly just their health-related vulnerability, but then there's also the setting itself. A lot of nursing homes are large facilities, basically congregate settings, where there's sometimes two or more people per room. And nursing home staff have to go from room to room caring for residents for hours a day. And so that setting in itself is just sort of the perfect storm for transmission of an airborne virus like this. And then at the same time, we have staff going in and out of the facility every day. So as much as you lock down a facility like this, it is connected to society. You can't really just wall off the residents and not have them see people who enter and exit the facility on a daily basis. And so that also facilitates transmission of a virus like this.
Right, right. Community spread plays a big part. So Nathaniel, is that why we're seeing spikes right now?
Yeah. I mean, when you're seeing spikes in the community, as we are throughout the entire country right now, you're going to see a corresponding spike in nursing homes. As Tamara just said, you know, nursing homes are connected to the community. So there's not really a way to, you know, as she said, completely wall it off. You've got the staff that are, you know, working sometimes multiple jobs, sometimes outside of the facility. So, you know, they have to go into the community. They have to go grocery shopping. They're exposed. So they're the risk vector here to bring the virus in.
And so, Nathaniel, how do you protect against that? Is it testing of staff or temperature taking? Does that even help?
Yeah, the biggest thing is mainly to test, to isolate once you see a positive test, and to make sure that the nursing home staff have appropriate protective equipment. Both of those things were issues throughout the early part of the pandemic and again into the fall. It's just making sure that facilities had enough tests to give to all of their staff and residents, making sure that they had enough of this critical PPE. And again, and that just also comes back to money and making sure that they have the funding to do those things.
And how are we doing any better right now?
In some places, but there have been really some issues with the rollouts of everything. Back in the fall, the Trump administration tried to give nursing homes these rapid point-of-care tests. Some of those tests worked, some of those didn't. some of the funding had sort of dried up until they just passed the new stimulus package. So that included some more money to help out with the testing and with the PPE. But, you know, like most of this pandemic, it sort of comes down to a lack of a coordinated federal response. Everything mostly has been left up to the individual states. So individual states have a conflict with the nursing homes, which have a conflict with the federal government. So everybody is sort of at odds with different policies. So it's hard to sort of have one underlying way to make things right.
So along with the health risks, there's also the isolation that has really taken a toll on residents. Tamara, can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. Back in March already, nursing homes basically locked down and stopped allowing visitors, according to federal guidance. The idea, of course, was that family members entering and exiting the facility would be at risk of bringing the virus in. And sort of in order to protect residents, visitors were prohibited. But it's become increasingly clear over the course of the pandemic that this kind of social isolation of nursing home residents has really taken its toll as well, and that we have to find a balance between, you know, the benefits of having visitors and keeping out, you know, any risk of the virus, because they're at risk anyway, because staff come and go every day. And so what some states have done, which is very encouraging, is set up programs called essential caregiver programs, where a designated family member can come in and visit. That family member also gets tested and wears the same PPE that staff does. But at least that resident then has interaction with the family. That family member can monitor the care that the resident is getting and prevent some of the worst effects of the social isolation.
Sure, sure. And that's interesting that some places have figured out a way to address the isolation. Do you think that there are COVID deaths and then there are COVID-related deaths? What I mean by that is, do you think that people are also dying from the isolation?
That's almost certainly true. There's been very little research on this so far, but more will be emerging, I'm sure, where, you know, we can look at the indirect effects of the virus, look at the effects of some of the policies we implemented, and start counting those indirect deaths as well.
Tamara Konecka is a health economist and professor at the University of Chicago, and Nathaniel Wexel is a health reporter at The Hill. Tamara, Nathaniel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Are you or is someone you know in a long-term care facility? How present is COVID there, and is the vaccine available? Tell us about your experience by sending us a voice memo, record it on your phone, and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
My name is Arthur Glauberman, and my relative is in an assisted living facility in New York State. I have to say that I feel that she's getting good care because we receive constant emails regarding the staff and who has COVID, and they're very responsible in terms of keeping us informed. She has not had COVID, which I consider to be a little bit of a miracle. And she is also a little bit confused and doesn't realize, since she's been in lockdown since the beginning of the pandemic. So it's a little hard for her to understand what the fuss is all about. But nonetheless, she has stayed safe. And the facility is hoping to have the vaccine within the next week or two, and we've all signed releases so that she'll be able to get the vaccine as soon as it's made available.
As you've heard, around 40% of all COVID-19 related deaths in this country have been linked to these types of facilities, and it's hitting the state of West Virginia hard. Sundale Nursing Home in Morgantown, West Virginia, was the first nursing home in the state to be hit with an outbreak of the virus back in March. 5 residents died there. Last month, Sundale also became the first nursing home in West Virginia to receive the vaccine. Michael Hicks is the CEO of Sundale and has been on the ground there since the outbreak in March. He joins me now. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy. It's a pleasure.
The deaths of so many nursing home residents has been one of the biggest tragedies of the pandemic. Tell us what those first few weeks of the outbreak were like at Sundale.
Not only were we the first facility in the state to have the coronavirus, we had the first community spread case in West Virginia. All other cases prior to that were associated with travel. And so to have it in the facility, I can still remember when I got the text message on Sunday the 22nd that one of our residents had tested positive. Just a sinking feeling. And the staff were just extremely hesitant also, not knowing what to do, how contagious this is. The only thing that we had heard is some of the stories from the state of Washington that had been hit prior to that. And of course, what was going on in Europe and Italy. We had this, Sundale is a 100-bed facility, and we had close to 100 people at that time. Our medical director, I can't say enough about him, Carl Schrader, was the first person to actually request that all residents and staff be tested. And at that time, that was just completely unheard of. The testing supplies were extremely limited, as were the labs to process. But he held out and worked with West Virginia University. We were able to secure enough kits. The National Guard came up and tested everyone. And we had a total of 21 residents that had tested positive and 9 staff members. But the thing is, 12 of the 21 were asymptomatic. And so that's how it spreads so quickly in a nursing facility.
Let's talk now a little bit about the vaccine. So you've gotten the vaccine now. How many people have you vaccinated? And who are you vaccinating first, the residents or the staff?
Residents, actually. As a matter of fact, the very first person was the first person to contract the virus. She was, her O2 stats had dropped. She was at Ruby Memorial Hospital, that's with WVU. She was in ICU and on a ventilator. She was probably on the ventilator for about, I'm thinking, a little more than a week. And the thing that's scary about that is, if you're on a ventilator for any extended period of time, chances are you don't get off that ventilator. So she started breathing above the vent, so they were weaning her off the ventilator. She came back to us at Sundale, and she was the first person to receive the vaccine. And we continued. We had 180 doses. We vaccinated 60 of our residents at that time.
Did you lock down, and was the isolation very hard for residents? And does the vaccine now mean that you can bring in visitors?
Well, no. The community spread in Morgantown is still significant in the county, actually. I think most of the counties in West Virginia are in a red status. So, yeah, we cannot open up the doors yet, but it does give us hope.
I see. And what about staff members?
We have about 50%, I think, of our staff have taken the vaccine. I wish it were more, and I'm going out and I'm talking with them, you know, whenever I get the opportunity. But, you know, there are some people that just have some, there are still some concerns about long-term effects. But in understanding the method in which this vaccine works, it's just true. This is not the vaccine that I grew up with, you know, where they inject you with a dead virus or a weakened virus and your system builds immunity. This is completely different. And I marvel at the technology. Apparently this has been used for about the last 10 years to deliver types of chemotherapy as well.
So Michael, how have the residents been dealing with the isolation and the separation from their families? Because that has to be very difficult on them.
This has been probably 9 months of the most difficult period of time that I can remember. Our residents, bless their hearts, we do family Zoom meetings, we do FaceTime, we do anything that we can to brighten their spirits. And especially at this time, Christmas and New Year, you know, we had Our activity staff decorated the facility just to the nines. It was great. And going around, we play bingo going down hallways. If you can imagine someone with a bullhorn at one end of the hallway calling out numbers. We just do anything that we can just to brighten their spirits. But it's so difficult. We have family members we do have some family meetings at the end of our buildings. We have a little vestibule where families can come in, and then there's a window separating them. But we do have microphones on both sides so that they can at least talk and with their family members and see them. But it's not the same thing as having the touch or having a hug. It sometimes it just breaks your heart. But we're doing what we can to lift their spirits in any way possible.
So tell me, many nursing homes entered into contracts with CVS and Walgreens. Did you do that?
No, we did not. And that's a really great question. And again, kudos to Governor Justice. Had we gone with the federal plan, which is what we were in originally, our vaccine, we would not have had, there are some states that have not received the vaccine yet that are in the federal plan. As of today, all nursing homes in West Virginia and assisted livings have already had their first vaccination. And as a matter of fact, this week we are having our second clinics. So we're having that second shot. It's been 21 days. So by doing this, it was hectic. It was chaotic. Things were moving so fast and then changing the next day. It was a little frustrating, but with the help of the National Guard, they were able to deliver the vaccines to five hubs in West Virginia. And we were lucky enough being here in Morgantown with WVU. WVU Medicine is one of the hubs. So that can store it at an ultra cold fashion. So kudos to everyone. And it's been hectic, but it's been great. And, it's the mood of the residents when we had the first vaccine clinic, it was like a party. And that was probably one of the best moments they'd had in the last 9 months.
Michael Hicks is the CEO of Sundale Nursing Home in West Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Cindy. It's been a pleasure.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's check in now on Iran, where a series of recent developments have complicated relations between Iran's government and the United States. Yesterday, Iranian officials announced that they've started enriching uranium at levels of up to 20% purity. This brings the country's nuclear program closer to how it looked before the 2015 nuclear deal with the U.S. and other global leaders. Iran also announced this week that its Revolutionary Guard has seized a South Korean tanker. The seizure was done in part to retaliate for the billions of dollars that Iran says South Korea owes its government, money that has been withheld due to U.S. sanctions. And while Iran claims it's willing to reverse both of these decisions, the developments make things much more complicated for the U.S. as our government prepares to transition between presidents. Joining me now to discuss is Golnaz Esfandiori, a senior correspondent with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who covers Iran. Thanks for being here, Golnaz.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
So tell us, how big of a shift is this latest uranium enrichment policy compared to how Iran's nuclear program has been operating recently?
The 20% enrichment is an increase from about 4%, which is set by the 2015 nuclear agreement that Iran signed with the Obama administration and other countries, and that President Trump abandoned in 2018. the 20% is basically a breach of this agreement. It brings Iran closer to being able to produce weapons-grade uranium, which is, I think, about it requires about 90% purity. But what is important to note, this is not a shift. It's basically since the U.S. left the agreement in May 2018, Iran waited for a year, and then it started gradually, step by step, violating the agreement and decreasing its commitment. So this seems to be in line with the steps Iran has been taking. I was a bit surprised by this because the 20% enrichment is a step required by the parliament. The parliament passed a law in December requiring the government to start enriching uranium at 20% immediately. And the bill passed by the parliament was opposed by the Iranian government. President Rouhani said that this is detrimental to diplomacy. And other Iranian officials also opposed it. And then suddenly, and they even passed a bylaw to delay this parliament bill. And then suddenly they announced that they've started enriching uranium at 20%. I think what is important also to understand is that Iran seems to be raising the pressure on the upcoming U.S. administration, on the Biden administration. And it's trying to gain leverage for potential talks between the two sides.
Okay, before we go there, we also mentioned Iran's seizure of a South Korean tanker. So what was that tanker carrying and why seize it?
I think the tanker was carrying ethanol, and the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, claimed that they seized the tanker because it was polluting the water in the Persian Gulf. But as you mentioned, it seems to be related to Iranian money that has been withheld in South Korea, in Seoul, because of U.S. sanctions. Iran has complained repeatedly that it hasn't been able to access its fund in order to buy humanitarian goods such as medicine and food. And then a South Korean diplomat was due to travel to Iran to discuss this issue. And then all of a sudden, we heard from the IRGC that they've seized the South Korean tanker.
Right. And so President Trump has very little time in office. Do you expect his administration to do anything before he leaves when it comes to Iran?
You know, it's very hard to say. President Trump can be unpredictable, as we know. There is concern among Iranian officials that the U.S. could launch an attack on an Iranian nuclear site or do something. But it seems that that's not the thinking in the Defense Department. The U.S. had sent B-2 planes and bombers, and also a carrier has remained in the Persian Gulf. But it seems that it's more to deter Iran from carrying any attack on U.S. forces. As you know, just a few days, January 3rd, was the anniversary of the U.S. drone attack that killed a prominent Iranian general, General Qasem Soleimani, who
right.
was the head of the Quds Force. Yeah. So the U.S. was concerned that Iranian forces or the Iran-backed groups in Iraq could carry out an attack.
Right. So you mentioned the Biden administration earlier. What do you expect from a Biden administration?
President-elect Biden has said that he's willing to re-enter the 2015 nuclear agreement if Iran returns to full compliance. Now, this latest move is aimed at increasing the pressure. But we'll see. I think there's still time for diplomacy because Iran has said that all these steps it has taken so far are reversible. So that leaves some time, a few months, for the Biden administration, the Rouhani administration, to enter in talks and possibly re-enter the nuclear deal.
Right. And there's also an election coming up in Iran later this year, so that could factor in as well?
Absolutely. In June, there's an election. And the parliament bill that was passed also seems to be a move of the power struggle ahead of the election, where the hardliners are expected to do well.
So all of these developments are happening against the backdrop of the pandemic. So what has the COVID-19 response looked like in Iran, and what is the country planning in terms of a vaccine rollout?
Iran has been dealing with one of the worst COVID-19 outbreaks in the Middle East, probably the deadliest. The first cases were reported back in February, but it seems that it started earlier and that the government did not announce to the people. There was the parliamentary election. It's not clear if they did not tell people because of that. They just announced two deaths just right before the election. And they didn't take any measures to protect the people. So it got really bad. They also didn't impose strict lockdowns initially. So it spread to the whole country and also to the region. So their response was very slow. It wasn't transparent. And they basically botched their response initially. Nowadays, they've imposed tighter restrictions. So the number of deaths and infection has dropped significantly. The official number, I must say. So back in November, I think it was every day about 400, over 400 people were dying from COVID-19 in Iran. And now today they announced that it dropped to below 198, I think. So that's, I don't know to what extent we can trust the numbers, but if true, it's a big achievement. Officials have been also blaming U.S. sanctions for their slow response, saying that they weren't able to impose very tight restrictions because they were afraid that the economy is going to collapse. You know, the Iranian economy is really in very bad shape due to crippling U.S. sanctions imposed by Trump after the U.S. exited the nuclear deal in 2018.
Right. And these sanctions, Gulnaz, isn't that part of what's holding up the money in South Korea?
They were initially saying that they wanted to access that money in South Korea to buy vaccines, but they were not able to. And then recently, the head of the central bank said that they got an approval from the U.S. Treasury to send money to a Swiss bank to purchase vaccine. He said there's, I think, sending about $240 million U.S. dollars to purchase about 17 million vaccines. He didn't exactly say where the vaccines would come from, but Iranian officials have said that they're probably not going to purchase the Pfizer vaccine because they said it's too expensive, and they also don't have the infrastructure needed for that. But they've also said that they're working on their own vaccine. They started the human trial recently. They inoculated, I think, 3 people, and then they did another trial on more people this week. And they've said that they're fine. But the problem, I think, would be that many Iranians would not trust that. And also, even if it's effective, it's going to take several months before they can use that vaccine, if mm-hmm. effective. We don't know. And Iranians, yeah, have been very worried, actually, about having access to vaccines. And just recently, lots of people, including health workers, had turned to Twitter to call on the government to buy safe and effective vaccines as soon as possible. I think they would not also trust Chinese vaccines, and Iran has rather good ties, so it's not clear if it's going to purchase vaccines from China.
It sounds like the Iranian people are really struggling with COVID-19, as is the rest of the world. Let's talk about the Biden administration again. What do Biden's foreign policy cabinet appointments tell us about how they might negotiate with Iran?
You know, President-elect Biden and Iran's foreign minister have met. Iranian foreign minister said in an interview that when he was the Iranian envoy to the UN, that he had meetings with Biden and others. So they know each other, not well, but at least they've probably talked. And I think and other people on the Biden team, including Jake Sullivan, and others, John Kerry, they know, they've been involved in the nuclear negotiation, Tony Blinken and others. So that probably is going to make it easier to deal with the Iranians to restart negotiation to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal. But it's going to be very difficult, I think, on both sides. There are the internal politics. There's going to be pressure on the Biden administration to keep the sanctions. And Iran has said that, you know, the sanctions have to be removed. And then another thing that's, I don't know how it's going to work, is the sequence. How they're going to do that is, I don't think the future administration is going to just remove sanctions. They're going to want Iran to go back to full compliance under the nuclear deal, then probably lift sanctions. So it's not going to be easy. But as I said earlier, I think there's still time for diplomacy. And I think both sides think that it's in their best interest to re-enter the nuclear deal. Now, the Biden administration has said that it wants to re-enter the nuclear deal and then build on it for a follow-on agreement or negotiations that would include issues such as Iran's regional activities and also missile program. But Iran has said repeatedly that, you know, that it's not going to negotiate over its missile program. So, and that's controlled by the hardline IRGC, and I don't see them being ready to compromise. But we have to wait and see. It's going to be a short time. Biden will be inaugurated on January 20th, and then Iran will have the its June election. So it's not also exactly clear how that's going to affect talks with the U.S. It's probably going to be easier for Biden to enter into negotiations with the Rouhani administration because they already know each other from talks that they held under President Obama.
Golnaz Esfandiari is a senior correspondent with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who covers Iran. Golnaz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In December, we brought you the story of Major League Baseball recently announcing it would officially give the Negro Leagues Major League status. That meant it would recognize the stats and records of the roughly 3,400 black players who played in the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948. Since we brought you that news, we've gotten a more personal take on the story.
My name is Dennis Biddle, a former Negro League baseball player. I played in 1953 and 54 with the Chicago American Giants.
Dennis is a former Negro Leagues player and president of Yesterday's Negro League Players Foundation. He's also the author of the book Secrets of the Negro Baseball League, as told by Dennis Biddle. Our friend Callie Crossley, who hosted last week on The Takeaway, got a chance to sit down with Biddle a few days ago to reflect on the moment.
I think it's a great thing to happen now. Should have happened years ago. I think about those old players that have passed on. They would have enjoyed the fact that they are being equal to something they already knew and couldn't do anything about it. What they're doing is a start, which is great. Recognizing those great ball players that did not have the opportunity to display their talents in the major league because of the color of their skin.
So because they're only recognizing the stats and records from 1920 to 1948, how will the numbers add up then? Because we're not going to know about the stats of the players who came after.
Right. And that's where it should have just said recognizing players that played in the Negro Baseball League as equal to the players in the Major League. Because they were. We were. And we couldn't do anything about it. We could only play each other on the game that we loved. We had to strive to be better just to prove how great we really were. I think of those older players that prepared us, the younger players, they went through a lot and had nothing to look forward to. We knew we had a chance with Jackie opening the door. But before then, they had no chance. And that's what really it bothers me when I say it's okay about the stats, but these men that live in now, and we have at least 40 players still living around the country that played in the 50s. The league did not end in 48. It ended in 1960.
Mm-hmm. So since you played in the later years, 1953, can you tell me a little bit about your time playing in the league?
Yes, I came in during a time when I knew I was being prepared for the major leagues by these older guys. You see, what happened after Jackie opened the door, most of the guys that was too old to go in at that time became coaches, trainers, managers, and owners at that time. And they were preparing the younger players for the major league. Now, this is something that was handed down to me. These men that gave so much to the game of baseball, the only recognition that they could get would be to say, I prepared Hank Aaron for the major leagues. Hank Aaron, Arnie Banks, and Willie Mays, and many, many more of them. This is all the contribution that they felt that they had to the game of baseball because they had no other recourse.
How did they prepare you? You were quite young when you played in the league.
I came in, I was 17 years old, right out of high school. And no scout scouted me. I'm from Arkansas, a little town in Arkansas. I pitched a no-hitter, and I was recognized by a booking agent from the Negro Baseball League who asked me, how would you like to play in the Negro Baseball League? I knew nothing about the Negro Baseball League. But I had to go from my hometown 1,000 miles to Chicago to play in the Negro Baseball League. And I'm grateful for the fact that that happened because I learned a lot about life. I was only 17 years old, and I'll never forget players like Double Duty Radcliffe and James Bell. They call him Cool Papa Bell. And they put their arms around the younger player and prepared us for what might come. In other words, we had a chance to go to the major leagues. And I'm appreciative of that today. And I know that's why years later, I became president of a foundation that was set up to recognize the living players of the Negro Baseball League.
So you met Jackie Robinson. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. Yes. I became a free agent with the Chicago Cubs in 1955. I met Jackie and we had dinner together downtown Chicago along with Ernie Banks and Gene Baker and Roy Campanella. And I'll never forget that. And I read about it. I knew we had gone through in the Negro League because I'd gone through it 2 years myself. But when he said, kid, they cannot write in a book or show in a movie what I went through. And being a young man like I, many days I wanted to go back home to mama. You know, I couldn't understand the treatment we were getting. And I said to him, Mr. Robinson, did you ever think about quitting? Because I did. He said, son, I thought about it every day. He said, but I had made a promise that I would open the door so other young black men players would be able to play in the major league. Jackie told that to me. That's something that will always be a part of me.
Now, do you feel the MLB decided to finally make this announcement to include the Negro Leagues now because it's been 100 years or because of the racial uprisings or both reasons?
I organized, along with Sherwood Brewer, we organized yesterday's Negro League Baseball Players Foundation in 1996. At that time, it was 314 of us still living around the country with no recognition. And, you know, the players, they didn't know what to do. They just went off little jobs and things. But Mr. Brewer, he had been trying for years to get them together, which was a hard thing to do, even today with the few players that are still living, because someone that will come up and offer them $100 to go sign autographs and do this, they'll go. And, you know, they are vulnerable to this kind of treatment. And Mr. Brewer always said, he said, if we stuck together as one, we would be a force to reckon with.
Do you feel the MLB can compensate the players who are still alive or their families?
I really do. I don't know how they can do it. But, you know, reparation is a hard thing to talk about these days. But those families should be considered. I don't know how they can do it. I just want something right now for the players that are still living. I want some recognition. I want monetary. I want money that they're giving these organizations that are preserving our history. Give it to the players that are still living. Make them a part of this. In 1998, thanks to Bud Seeley, helped the organization get benefits for 79 players that were still living. They got the Major League pension fund. But the criteria they set was 4 years in the Negro League, and most of those players were dead and gone. A few of them did qualify. I asked the commissioner to lower the criteria to 1 year. If he would do that, that would include every player that's still living that played in the Negro Baseball League. But I have not heard back from him after two letters to him.
Do you think there's a chance that it could still happen, given that there's a lot of attention to this move by the MLB?
I'm hoping it will.
Well, Mr. Biddle, thank you so much for keeping the flame alive.
Thank you.
Dennis Biddle is a former Negro League player and president of yesterday's Negro League Players Foundation. He's also author of the book Secrets of the Negro Baseball League, as told by Dennis Biddle. He spoke with GBH's Callie Crossley. We reached out to Major League Baseball for comment about Mr. Biddle's letters asking for pensions for all living Negro League ball players. They sent us a pair of press releases from 2004. And that's all we have for you guys today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a voice memo. Record it right on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet at Cynrod. That's C-Y-N-R-O-D. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Cindy Rodriguez in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.